Everybody please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. I want to thank everybody for coming tonight. We've got a lot of great presentations, so to start us off.
Yeah, I'm just going to go a little out of order if the Board of Education doesn't mind, because we have some young people I know. I don't know if you have any more exams coming up or maybe want to make up. So I'm going to start with the students first, and just we have a presentation of the yearbooks, and we would ask the high school students if you would just come on up and present the yearbooks, your names and who you are and anything you want to say.
So, I don't know who to face, but... So, as the three of the class officers out of four of the class of 2017, we just wanted to present these yearbooks to the board members and to Mrs. Angolia to show our appreciation for all they've done for our education and just give them a little gift to remember us by. So, the first yearbook will be presented to Mr. Foster.
Thank you very much.
And then Mr. Ely. Mrs. Rayburn. And Mr. Hogan.
Thank you very much.
Mrs. Patanjo.
Thank you.
And Mrs. Angolia. And we hope you guys can look back at these and remember our class in a good light. And thank you very much for all you do.
Thank you.
And we have our 8th grade class president.
On behalf of the 8th grade class, I want to thank you guys for all that you do and just to remember us in these yearbooks. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrew will be giving a very important speech tomorrow night, so stay tuned. I'm very excited. Just praying I'm not after.
I think I'm one of the last.
You're ready?
Yeah.
Good.
I just want to say the class of 2017, I'm the class of 1997 from Sedimentary, so this is my 20th anniversary. So this is really cool to have 20 years later to see you guys and how going to all of your inductions and stuff has been a great privilege for me. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Okay, thank you. You also, board, as you know, we have a policy as far as the dedications to the school district. And what basically happens is if somebody wants to do a dedication, the board present their thoughts, and then the board either approves it or doesn't. And tonight we have Mr. Christopher Shrump, one of our leaders in our custodial staff, as well as Tom Kelly. If you would just come up to the microphone and...
Sure. Mr. Clancy, too.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Clancy, I didn't see you.
No problem.
I apologize.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Stewart. As you know, this was a rough year for our buildings and grounds department. We lost two members, Chris Lee, back in October, passed away suddenly. And we were thinking, we had several meetings of Mrs. Bates, Mr. Clancy, and Chris about what to do. We were thinking about planting a tree in front of the high school, something to remember by in the spring. But then suddenly, Jimmy Williams passed away in February. So we were thinking, what could we do to honor both of them? And the three of us came together, and we had multiple meetings, like I said, with Mrs. Bates, and we decided to do a plaque, similar to what the security staff did for Stan, who passed away 2 years ago. So the idea is to put a plaque in front of the security office in the high school main lobby. So if you're okay with that, we'd like to do that maybe in the September, do a little ceremony with the Lee and the Williams family.
I think it's a great thought, and I really applaud the thought and the caring.
Well, like I said, Mr. Clancy, I'd like to say a quick word too. It was huge, pretty much his brainstorm he came up with this. So thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wow, this is not a position I'm usually in. I actually wrote this about Chris earlier in the year in my weekly notes. And Semmer just lost a man who genuinely cared about our district, who's a member of our educational team. He can be seen on his off hours watching our school plays and sporting events, asking teachers if they needed help adjusting their rooms, or even coming down to see me as the co-chair of our schools to say no to the bullying club about incidents he saw that might be bullying and let me know of the behavior of some students. Chris will be missed in our building and all buildings around the school.
Thank you. So, if you want to make a motion, Josh, in regards to accepting the plaque?
Sure. Motion to accept the dedication of a plaque, and it doesn't matter where it is.
It's going to be secondary.
Should we put up the secondary campus?
Motion.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Yes.
Motion carries unanimously. Again, I applaud you. I think it's really great to honor your fellow community members in that way.
Thank you. Okay, I see Steve's back there, so I'm going to move forward. As the board knows, we had a comprehensive assessment of our security services here at Center Ridge School District. We did, for the public's knowledge, have members of the South County Police Department as well as an outside agency come to our exec session last meeting, discuss some of the findings. The reason we did that is some of the things are very sensitive in nature and confidential, so we could not report to the public. But tonight we're going to report to the public some of the things that were found, and I will leave it for Ms. Goldie. Do you want to begin with
sure.
that?
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. As Mr. Stewart mentioned, you know, emergency preparedness and school safety really is at, should always be on our minds, and we should always be aware of the world around us, whether it's the global society or our local issues that come up, and that typically direct us to think about our own safety and our own emergency preparedness procedures. Really pleased. I mean, you've seen other presentations and probably heard from the school community that, you know, several years ago, Mr. Caswell really was a leader, not just in our district, but really in Suffolk County with the help of our SRO officers and Suffolk County Police Department in developing the most effective emergency procedures and protocols for schools. So that is definitely not the work of just a few people. We have an emergency preparedness committee that met regularly. They did research. There are members of our community who are involved in emergency services on that committee, board members, our own security staff, and they spent an inordinate amount of time to go through these newer procedures and protocols. And our administrative team from Mr. Caswell, Ms. Bates, Ms. Hardwick, they've really taken all the work of that group and really put it into action here, where Senator Riches really was like the front runner and the model school for emergency preparedness. So it's always going to be something that we're going to continue to look at time and time again to make sure that our schools are as safe as possible. And at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Caswell and Mr. Hughes. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. So like Ms. Ngoli was saying, emergency preparedness is just as important as math curriculum or DASA or any facet of education. So over the last several years, we worked very, very hard and diligently to have the most up-to-date emergency preparedness plan possible. And it's never done. It's absolutely never done. It's always evolving, always changing. Analogous to or comparative to CPR. I mean, you know, any one of us have done CPR training through the years, we've seen how much has changed every single year. There's some new layer or revision or edit or whatever it's going to be. So with emergency preparedness, probably the best way to think about it as a common reference point is we all know what to do in a fire drill. Every one of us has gone through school since kindergarten, and none of us really react in a negative way with anxiety. We just hear the fire alarm, and we know exactly what to do. And that's a result of continual training since kindergarten, constantly. And some people look at it as an inconvenience. In the old days, we used to do 12 fire drills a year, and people would be like, oh my gosh, why are we doing so many drills? Well, I'll tell you why we do so many drills, because last fall at SUNY Purchase, there was a fire in the freshman dorm just before school started. The entire dorm burned down. Zero fatalities. The reason being because everybody evacuated the building in less than 3 minutes. Why? They were just graduates of high schools who have done many, many fire drills. So as that as a reference point, unfortunately, in this day and age, we've had to add many, many new types of drills, not just fire drills. In fact, the state has finally recognized that, so they've actually reduced the number of fire drills from 12 to 8, and now they've added lockout or lockdown drills to bolster this whole notion of emergency preparedness. So when the state finally recognizes something, you know it's a real big deal. So what we did this year was we reviewed all emergency procedures with the entire district, every single staff member. We ran a series of workshops and conference days, and we went through all the different types of drills. Fire drill, lockout, lockdown, what to do in a bomb scare, what to do in evacuation, right? All of these new layers that have been a result of our changing society. The bottom line is our goal is to have our school community, but specifically our staff and students, to react just like they would in a fire drill, without panic, without thinking, without any anxiety. They just react, and they know what to do. So when we're talking about lockout and lockdowns, for whatever reason, whether there's a threat on the outside of the building in the school community, whether there's a threat inside the building, whether it's an irate parent or a vicious dog or someone bringing in a weapon, regardless of the incident, inside or out, students and staff were trained to find the nearest lockable room. That's the same type of reaction they would have with a fire drill. Fire drill, they get out of the building. Lockout, lockdown, they find the nearest lockable room. And we've done so many of them through the years is that we're starting to see a cultural shift in the reaction. Because for the first time, years ago, we did a lockdown or a lockout drill, there was a lot of anxiety. You certainly remember that as well, Officer Hughes. A big part of the success of implementing programs like we just mentioned is our partnership with the Suffolk County Police Department. Without Officer Hughes, without Officer Lawrence, without any of the officers of the 7th Precinct, we would not have had the support and the resources to lay out a very, very progressive plan. Officer Hughes and I worked very, very closely through the years. He is works at the Suffolk County Police Academy, moving on and training our next generation of police officers. But nonetheless, the relationship between the police department and Center Richard School District is very, very strong indeed. And it's such a relief for me as a principal of a high school or a member of a community to have such an important partner. And I can't thank Officer Hughes enough. But we'll be hearing a little bit more about him as well. And additionally, Officer Hughes was an integral part of our Emergency Preparedness Committee, which we hold several meetings a year. And like Mr. Goldie said, we were able to accomplish a lot in a little amount of time. And I'm not sure what we're going to do now, or probably with Officer Hughes, some of the things we are going to actually be able to implement. That was a result of the Emergency Preparedness Committee several years ago. A lot of these are budgetary items and things of that nature. So I guess we'll get to that a little bit. Right?
Yep.
Okay. Officer Hughes.
Sure. For those of you that don't know me, I think a lot of you do know me. I've been in the police corps for now 12 years. I'm retired from the military. I work now for Aspis Group. Aspis Group is a security firm that only hires veterans/police officers, either current or retired. So within Aspis Group, I am specifically working with school issues and school safety. Have done school resource officer position for 3 years prior to going to the police academy. Now I teach tactics at the police academy. I've worked with Senator Richards since the beginning. St. Richard's was the first school that was completely open to change to get in line with the threats that were going on in the country. The plan that was put together by Mr. Caswell and myself and all the members of St. Richard's School District actually brought forth change in the state. We completed a plan that was head and shoulders above every other plan on the island. We brought that to the state, made changes that have then come down to the county. So there are at least a dozen schools in the county right now that have adopted the same plan, style of plan that Senator Rich's helped create. So while I was a Marine, I was an embassy guard. I worked for the Department of State. I created the security plans for embassies overseas. So the plan for a school is very similar to an embassy. Keep the bad guys out. If they get in, stop them before anybody gets hurt. So we work off of that on a perimeter physical security. That is, how do you keep them off our property? How do we keep a problem off the property or identify it before it can get near our students? So as we did the threat assessment for the school, we figured out many different things that we can do to secure the perimeter of the building, which has been brought forward. I don't know how in-depth you would like to get. But many different ideas have been brought forward to the maximum amount of security on down to what budgetary can be handled. Facility, physical security. What can we do once they get onto the property and now have approached the school? How do we keep them from getting access into the school? What things can we change? What things are we doing right? There are so many things done right in your school district right now. You have reached the capacity of what could have been done up until now. Facility physical security and perimeter physical security also includes cameras, identification, different things that we can relate to the police department so that if there is an issue that then goes away, the police department can then use camera footage, recorded, and identify people and bring people to justice, even though nothing took place. Okay. The current personnel utilization. Now, where people are located, how many more people would be suggested through our threat assessment, how many more people could be on hand to bring the security up to a higher level. So those are the three areas that we looked at. And that goes from such things as gates, fences, door alarms, motion detectors, cameras, all the way down to personnel and where personnel are placed. The recommendations with those additional cameras also came access control issues. Many schools come into the problem of, you know me, you should let me come on the property. You know my kids, you've known them for 10 years, why are you asking me for my ID? Many things come into play with that. Okay. If we talk about access cards to a school, and when I worked at the embassy, there were colonels that had much more rank than me. And they would come to the gate and they would say, hey, Sergeant Hughes, can you let me in? And I'd say, I'd love to, sir. Can I see your ID? And he says, you know who I am, and I'm a colonel. Now let me in. And I say, sir, I'd really like to see your ID. And the reason is not because I don't know who he is, but the question is, where's your ID? And can somebody who shouldn't have it possibly have it in their possession? Show me your ID. I have you connected to that. No one else can use it to gain access. So those are the type of things that may change a bit, that may raise some people's angst when they come up to the school and say, well, I don't want to show my hand. I don't want to give you my driver's license. But remember, all we're worried about is the children's safety and staff. Okay. Perimeter considerations, like I said, gate, possibly barricades. Now, one of the concerns that we've dealt with in every federal building across the country and across the world is if somebody drives a car, are we expecting somebody to drive up to our doors with a fertilizer bomb? But is it possible that somebody loses control of their car and starts barreling toward the front door? We have nothing to stop that car from entering the front of the building. So there's certain types of barricades that can be put into place that are aesthetically pleasing. Big flower pots, things like that that would stop that kind of an issue. So a lot of those things were also recommended. Different styles. Additional security personnel is one of the key things that were suggested through the threat assessment, just to make sure that we have enough guards on hand at each location at the right times that we can control access as well as control issues at the same time. We cannot have one guard control access and control issues. So in certain areas, we were recommending for additional guards and that those numbers have been discussed. So there are so many issues within this that I would love to discuss with you, but because of the nature of issues such as, and I'll give you a little example of, if we had to evacuate the school, where would we go? A lot of parents want to know, where are you going to take my kids? Well, we would take the kids to an unknown place to you until you are notified. This way, that information can't lead to a possible threat, and then that threat would have two locations set up for a problem. So as soon as we evacuate, they'd be waiting at the second location. So I have talked with a lot of schools, and a lot of parents want to know that. Where are you going to take my kids? Like, we won't tell anyone until the time comes. You'll get notified. Police will be on hand. Your children will be in the safest place possible for when you arrive. And then the handoff of children to their parents will take place in a secure location with police officers, with identification, and school personnel to make sure children are back with their parents. Okay. I'll take any questions that you have. Any questions that I could possibly answer, I will. Anybody has it.
Probably should go to Raina, because I know that you did bring a little bit of the presentation, and then certainly with Ricardo, is still going to runs parallel with security.
Some of the absolutely. Control.
So maybe at the end we'll go to the complete end. I think it's probably best if you don't mind at that point.
Sure.
You want to speak a little more?
Yeah, sure. So it is interesting how worlds do collide. As you'll hear in a little bit, you know, throughout this year we've done a lot of visitations for the International Baccalaureate Program. And as Ed and I would enter schools, one of the first things that we thought about was, who's greeting me? What are they taking my picture? Are they scanning my license? And in every case, I think it was yes. And then as we walk through the school, were we allowed to walk freely? How many times did a security guard pass us? Where are their cameras? How do they handle their dead zones in their schools? So it's, you know, it is something that, you know, we can learn a lot from our neighbors, and we have learned a lot from, and really what kind of technology, what kind of facility enhancements are out there that we can take advantage of. And really through the planning of both Emergency Preparedness Committee and the Capital Project work and Smart Schools, we've covered a lot of these areas. So first with the Capital Project, we had a complete renovation of our interior door hardware. That doesn't sound very exciting, but in terms of running our lockout and lockdown protocols, is essential. So basically what that enhancement was that instead of, as a teacher, fumbling for my keys, my door is immediately locked, and I'm not spending that time trying to secure my classroom. The film on the interior door windows, I know, came out of that committee as well. It just secures the glass portion of the door a bit more. And I think the most significant accomplishment really was the vestibule. That was... I mean, we thought about everything from how do you get the kids' stuff to the security guard, where the security guard's going to be, the material that the vestibule is built around. We've worked with our district architect to design it. So that really came from the technology that would be in the vestibule. That really came from several different layers. So when you talk about, you know, school security and safety, the layers are endless almost, because it really is. You need every single mind thinking about this from every single angle. So Mr. Soto is going to talk about Smart Schools a bit, but also some of our security enhancements really in line with Smart Schools. Our PA system updated Clayton Huey. You know, it was an older system, and that communication piece in terms of school safety, and really just daily communication is essential. One of the recommendations, and really something we've been talking about from both the committee and through the threat assessment, was additional interior and exterior cameras to cover, you know, when we're looking for a kid, something happens, and the kids know where the cameras are and aren't. So the whole idea now is to make sure that as much footage is covered as possible if we're looking for somebody, or just to have the ability to scan through a building in a few minutes, you know, in a second is really important. This year, the identification system was implemented at both Clayton Huey and Secondary Campus. If you've come up to visit the school, you know all about this. You have to submit your license. They get you a scanned badge. And that is not just for identification, but it tracks the traffic in and out of the school. And what's also coming, I believe, this summer is a door strike system.
Yes.
Also through Smart Schools. And that really addresses the issue that Officer Hughes brought up about access to the buildings. It will really, I think, streamline access to the buildings, and it will give access to exactly those people who need access and when they need access to the building. So, and it really helps with the record keeping of who's coming into the building at what time. You know, some schools have gone as far as student identification. At this time, it's really going to be staff, faculty and staff having that access. But it will tighten the security from that perspective, from that angle.
Sure.
Do you want me to speak to this piece, or do you want me to go into the presentation?
You can go into
okay, because the presentation we have will address what smart schools will cover. As Ms. Agolia and Mr. Caswell and Mr. Hughes kind of mentioned, smart schools is going to cover the bulk of what you see here in terms of the security features that we're adding, such as the interior cameras, as well as the exterior cameras, the door strikes. That was something that the technology committee looked at very hard in terms of how can we ensure the increased security of our staff as well as our students. So we're going to get into this. This is only one component of the 10 various expenditure items that are part of the Smart Schools Improvement Plan.
Okay, can you start pulling up to get a chance?
Sure.
We should also know on July 11th, which is our next Board of Education meeting, we're going to have a presentation with regards to phase two of the capital bond. So we'll have our construction manager here. I think I emailed the board about this. We're going to have our construction manager, as well as Gary Krause, going to be here. I'm sure Tom Kelly and others, just to talk about phase two, how it's going to kind of flow over the next 6 or 8 months. But yeah, you can. Out of you, do you want to take questions? Do you want to ask any questions, Jeff Board, or you want to just go to Ricardo with this?
Hey, you want to take a second to ask questions?
If anybody has any questions, you want to ask.
The audience and the board.
Right, if not, then we'll just move on.
If I wanted to get into my classroom at 10 o'clock on Saturday morning, would I be able with the thing? Because that's not a normal time.
If you have the ability that is computerized now, so it will say Mr. Clancy has access, like the coaches do as well, to certain times in the building. Yeah. If your name and your code is put in there, the answer is yes.
Okay, great.
You would have to just inform us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do the alarm still be on?
No. If the alarm is on weekends, that wouldn't, disengage the alarm. The alarm would still be on.
Okay.
So, I mean, you would have to come at a time where the alarm isn't engaged. If
okay.
It is, then obviously the motion detectors will swap you.
Okay.
It would not be a good situation.
Okay.
But I think a key takeaway from your presentation was, without going into the details, we had asked, are we doing the most that we can? You know, as Mr. Caswell said, safety is the number one thing that we do. Without that, we can't do anything else. And, we've asked, how can we be better? So we've now got a list of things, which we're not going to share publicly for all the reasons that you said, as to how we can be better that we can consider over time. And I think that's the key. You can always be more secure, and you have to weigh that with, many, many other considerations, including, fortunately and unfortunately, financial considerations.
And some of it was, it was wonderful. It's some of the things that the company recommended that we already, whether it was alarms on doors, swipes, things of that nature, the vestibule at the high school that's about to be put in, all those things were already on a way, which is, exciting. But there definitely are other things just to keep taking to that next level that would come.
And are we properly deploying all of the resources that we've got today in the manner that is most efficient? So I think now we've got that information, and we can, continue to look at that and talk about that as budget.
Ricardo, how do you log on anybody who, a grandmother, is a parent, get automatically logged on?
Log on to the system.
So they can enter so that they're in the system.
You can't, non-staff members won't be able to just come into the building.
So but a parent visiting?
A parent visiting, what would happen is that we would have that entrance point monitored by security. So the security officer will let the person in and then scan the individual's ID and make a determination as to why the person's in the building. The person coming in for a meeting, exactly. The person coming to pick up their grandchild, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, Clancy's talking about all the other doors because we're going to have six or eight doors that staff can go through.
Across the district, we're going to have 12. 6 at the secondary and 6 at the elementary. Door strikes that will be accessed by all personnel.
We're going to continue business as usual now, both the main lobbies coming in. And we just just implemented the system. And the question is, how hard do we want to be the first couple of months as people were coming in that we knew? But as we move forward, we're definitely going to get tighter with making sure that that everyone follows exactly the procedures.
But the thought that there's not a reason for you to be in the building, you don't need to be in the building, and that's how you speak, you know.
Yeah. And we're going to stop a lot of what happens is that, you know, when somebody, once they're in the building and you do one thing, you have sometimes people begin to wander. You know, so I didn't care what I needed to take taken care of. I dropped off my lunch for my son and daughter at the main lobby, but now I'm going down. And by the way, I want to thank the art teacher. And boy, it's only three doors away, and let me knock at the door. So I think the vestibule will stop. You know, not that anybody's there to do anything bad, but it does disrupt, you know.
And you don't know. I mean, that's the reality. It's a crazy world, in my view, and you don't know. So if there's not a real need for us, that's why we have one.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Phil. Marcus, you want to join me? I'm joined by Mr. William Nilfie, as well as Mr. Marcus Babbitt, two members of the Technology Committee. Oh, yes, thank you. Thank you. Two members of the Technology Committee, what we hope to present to the board and community this evening is kind of a status report as to where this Munson's Bond Act, I mean, improvement plan is at this point. So we're going to walk the Board of Education. I do have presentations for everyone. There are extra presentations in the back of the conference room, if everyone could just, that's Josh. Once again, like I said, we want to walk the community and the Board of Education through sort of a timeline of how we got to where we are now, as well as walking everyone through the 10 expenditure items that are part of the Smart Schools Improvement Plan, which was adopted by the board and later approved by New York State Department of Education. So I'd like to begin with just the timeline. If
I think that set me up there, but... Okay.
So the timeline, believe it or not, we got into this process back in November of 2014. That's when the Smart Schools Bond Act was approved by the voters. It was $2 billion that the state decided that schools should have to improve the technology. Now, the Smart Schools Bond Act is specific to certain things. One, the state says, we want the school districts to improve its technology. In the form of Wi-Fi, in the form of computers that students can utilize to sort of enhance the instruction process, and security measurements, and that's why we do have the security measurements that are part of the Smart Schools Improvement Plan. But it was very specific to these four items. It cannot be used for capital improvement. We can't even use the funds for software improvements. If we wanted to purchase a software where we don't work, was educationally sound, would improve the educational or academic output of our students, we couldn't purchase it. It was specific to infrastructure and specific to technology that would be in the hands of students. So that was approved, and I'm sorry for the color, and you can't probably see it, but it was approved on November 4th, 2014. On November 19th of 2015, the Technology Committee actually presented to the Board of Education its preliminary plan, which basically from, I would say, about January, we began to get together, January of 2015 for about 7 to 8 months. The committee was comprised of, obviously, the two gentlemen that I have behind me, as well as other teachers, staff members, community members. Mr. Foster was a member, is a member at this time, and was a member back then. And what we did is that we got together and we looked at the amount of money that was allocated to Center Richards. And the amount, which you're going to see momentarily, is $1,034,558. That number is like stuck in my head like glue, but I can't forget that number. But that's the allocation that was allocated to Center Richards School District. Like I said, the $2 billion was spread across the entire state, so every district got a kind of piece of the pie, and it was based on a formula that New York State Department of Education created. What that formula is, I have no idea, Carol. Maybe Carol would have some insight on that, but I definitely don't. But like I said, our allocation was $1,034,558. So as a committee, we looked at what were the strengths of the committee, I mean, what was the strengths of the district in terms of technology, and what were some of the weaknesses? What are areas that we need to improve upon? How could we best utilize that particular fund? So in about, I think, 7-8 months, we had a plan. We presented it to the Board of Education on November 19th. The Board of Education liked the plan at the time, and we put the plan forth for their adoption, which they actually adopted the plan on January 28th of 2016. Once again, I apologize for the print. On January 28th, which literally was the next day, I submitted the plan to New York State Department of Education for approval. Now, what was very, I still think of this as very comical to this date, was that when New York State Department of Education first devised the Smart Schools Improvement Plan, they said that the process would be easy. They said you could just submit your PowerPoint, and we take a look at your expenditure items, and we're, you know, approving. That was not the case. It went through a tedious process, approval process, where I actually had to go through four stages. What the presentation you see that I presented to, that we presented to the Community Board of Education, that was nothing to what I had to present. I actually had to, and Bill helped me with it. I think I showed Marcus at one point. It was about 35 pages of various anecdotal information, technical information that thankfully I had Bill by my side that we had to present. And beyond that, it had to go through four different stages. The first stage was just the preliminary plan stage, where the committee would look at your plan and say, okay, does it make sense? Then you had to make some modifications in the language. Then it went to the expenditure committee. Then you had to submit all your quotes to the state of all the vendors that you were proposing that you were going to use. And then you had to get past that. Then there was another committee, which I forget the name of this committee, but there was another committee I had to get through. And then finally it went to the final committee, which was approved on January 20th of 2017. So once again, it takes us literally almost a year and a half from implementation of the plan, actually a full year, implementation of the plan to approval by New York State Department of Education. On February 1st, we met again as a committee to define the priorities for the 10 expenditure items. So tonight, we're going to go through each of the items, and we're going to give the community and Board of Education insight into what we believe should be the implementation schedule, and what technically it is at this point for some of it. So I'm going to turn it over now to Marcus to go through the five items.
Okay, thank you, Ricardo. So as you mentioned, the total dollar amount is at the top of the slide there, and the items, the individual items have their dollar amounts listed, so the one all the way on the left, we actually already heard quite a bit on in detail of what's in that. That particular item actually predates even the timeline that Ricardo just put up, so when the state was still formulating the Smart Schools Initiative, before they even put it before the voters, we got wind of this, and this was when John Allen was still here. So we were able to bring in vendors, and we got recommendations that the state would actually look more favorably upon proposals that included a security component. So we got involved in that very early on, and the process sort of grew out of that and then encompassed all of these other items that you see. So that first item, the increased security measures, that's already underway. As you heard, a lot of that is in place already. On the blue oval there, you can see that the additional cameras that will be going throughout have already had wires put in place, and the wiring for the door strikes is in place, so there's very little to be left on that, to be done still on that. And basically all of the items that you see here, they're either due to be completed by August or before the beginning of the school year, so that they're in place for next year. The second item, the district-wide wireless. So that's a key component. Another thing that we did in formulating this plan is we actually looked at neighboring school districts. So to try to get some idea of what our strengths and weaknesses were vis-a-vis the other schools on Long Island. And we got quite a bit of information from them on what they had in place for their students in terms of computer access, things like wireless,
things and other quantities of computers that they have available, what kind of STEM equipment they're using in their labs and things like that. So the district-wide wireless was one item that everybody around us already had. So we knew we had to implement that. And this basically will give access throughout all of the buildings and the campus, so both the primary and secondary campuses. And that will enable a number of things, specifically the last column of Chromebooks, which I'll come to in a minute. And there'll also be some potential for guest access in the buildings going forward in the future. And that's already in place, some of that. So the components, as you can see, they've been ordered and received, and wiring and installation on that will commence shortly. So again, it looks like we're on track with that to finish it in August. The wireless bridge replacement was another thing that we looked at quite extensively. So what that is, that basically links the networks, the independent networks of the two campuses into one network. So it's a microwave link between the two buildings, and that allows staff and administrator access to the software that they use no matter which building they're in. And critically, it also enables the nightly on-site backups that are performed computer systems throughout the district. So that was actually something very important to maintain. The existing system is well past its lifetime, and it's also gotten, as technology has expanded, it's gotten relatively slow. So this new system will be new equipment at higher speed, so it'll be able to keep pace with the growth of the facilities. That's also, as far as I understand, a relatively quick hardware swap out. So again, we're on track for an August completion. The next item was something that a lot of our educators were excited about. So as you can imagine, district-wide microscopes, these will allow the teachers to take small objects, especially things like bugs or anything you'd want to show in a science class or interesting stuff like that, and then project them onto either the screens or the smart boards in the classrooms. And so this would allow us to outfit all of the classrooms with those devices. And then finally, we come to a pretty exciting one for everyone, that's Chromebooks and carts. And so this will give our students access to laptops in the classroom. And what we're able to budget for that is not one computer per student, but we ordered enough so that every grade in the district will have at least enough laptops to cover one classroom. So the classrooms would need to rotate, but it works out to about 25 or 30 notebooks, and they're stored in a cart so they can move around to the different classrooms. And every grade would have a dedicated cart, as well as some extra carts for specific subject areas or to be allocated in other ways. So while it's not something that the students will be able to take home, they will have quite a bit of access throughout the year to these in the classroom. And so the Chromebooks work through Google. They're being supplied by Dell. And so this is part of the transition that the district is making over to Google Docs. And that's also moving ahead pretty rapidly, and looks like it will be ready for the start of the next school year. So for the next five items, I think Bill is going to take that on.
Thanks, Marcus. So we're in the middle of a big transition now, so we have a few more items have to go, as Marcus talked about. One of the key ones was the district-wide wireless. That, unfortunately, has to go first, because a lot of other projects hinge on that, such as the Chromebooks and some of our other systems that are going into place. We're upgrading our internal infrastructure, and what that means is the back end in the closets where all the computers and all the other devices connect to, there's switches and there's switching components in there that has to all be upgraded and updated. A lot of the new systems, such as the PA intercom system and the camera system, they work over what's called PoE, Power Over Ethernet. So we need these new switches in place before the new cameras and the new intercom systems can work. That's also happening this summer. As you see, a lot of it's happening during the summer. Why? Because the students aren't here, the teachers aren't here. So we have 2 months to get everything done and get everything into place. The STEM elective equipment, we're going to be purchasing stuff. They're part of the construction at the high school, the secondary campus, is their building
some new classroom spaces. So part of that, what we came up with, was to outfit it with all this great new STEM-style equipment, 3D printers and oscilloscopes and possibly a CNC machine. I know at the elementary school, some STEM stuff we're looking at getting is like robot kits for the library. Ms. Craig is very into programming and coding and stuff with the kids, so we're doing some stuff for the library down there. The elementary intercom system, which we were talking about before, that's something that's going in this summer as well. That has to be, again, has to be, it's going to start getting wired now. They're starting to go work on it during the summer, but we need that other part, the internal infrastructure, the switches and stuff in place before that can get fully operational. The other exciting piece is the desktop computers for the classrooms. I'm sure everyone knows, we've heard, our computers are slow, they're old, they're antiques, they're garbage. Well, we're replacing every classroom machine this summer. A big project, to be sure, but every classroom is getting a brand new computer in there that's going to be hooked up to the smart board or projector that's in the classroom. So that's, you know, a great thing we're looking forward to. Again, during the summertime, when no one's here, it makes it a lot easier to move everything around. But a lot of it hinges on, too, as you'll see, some of this has to wait until some of the construction is done, or Tom Kelly and his crew, everybody knows the classrooms get cleaned out and redone all summer long. So we kind of try to stage everything and make everything so we're not working twice. We don't want to have to have the computer stuff come in, put it in one spot, then wait, and then move it around again. So we're trying to coordinate everything as best we can so we're minimizing our moves and minimizing the exposure of equipment. Finally, the document cameras. We have a bunch of document cameras now. Part of our plan was to get one for every single classroom. Instead of the teachers having to share, we're getting a document camera for every classroom so everyone has one available. No one has to wait. No one has to take one from the library or, you know, worry about, you know, do I have a say? But, yeah, we planned a lot of stuff for the summer, and hopefully if everything goes according to plan. Everything comes together by September 4th.
Yeah.
As we've begun this implementation, have we run into any cost overruns, things that we didn't foresee?
Not going to work.
So we're dead on where we thought we would be.
We're actually even a little less in certain areas. I believe the Wi-Fi actually is coming in a little less. I mean, not a lot less. I don't want to get everyone excited, but not a lot less.
Do we even have the right to use that if it's less? Like, can we reallocate or go back to the state?
We have the right to reallocate 25% of the entire plan. So we could reallocate, let's say, up to $250,000. Without board approval, we do have to submit the modifications to the community. We have to put it up on the website for about 2 weeks and then get state approval again.
But we're not going over.
No, we're not.
And we will know when, by August, September, if we've come in.
Well, some of these, yes, we will. A lot of these, we actually have the quotes already, and we actually have the POs filled. So we're fine. I just have to take a moment to kind of give a plug to Mr. Nofi as well as Mr. Wright. When you look at some of these items, sometimes I think as individuals sitting back, we forget the magnitude of the organization that is involved in this. I mean, I've been working with Bill, you know, for years now, and I'm just so impressed with Bill as well as Leonard, as well as the entire staff, that we can coordinate this. And I think he wants to, like, beat his head against my desk at some points, because I'll give you an example. For the STEM elective equipment, we can't put the things in until we have the phase two of the capital improvement plan completed, because that is going to be contingent on it, because we're actually building a brand new classroom for the high school, a STEM lab, which I'm excited about. I think we all are as educators, as community members. I think it's a great thing for the high school, but that room has to be done before we can even step in. So the coordination that's involved in just getting the equipment ready and having it ready to, like, run in, like, the last week or two is going to be very impressive. I'm very excited to be there, a part of it, and I think I'm confident that the board and the community is going to be very impressed with the finished product.
Yeah, if I could, Ricardo, I just wanted to add on the question about the budgeting. While we think that the STEM, or it's actually STEAM now, but we think that's important, but that sort of, in one sense, that was sort of the bottom of the barrel. So we looked at all these other things, and you needed a certain amount of Chromebooks per class and things like that. So some of those things were pretty fixed. The STEM elective equipment is a la carte, right? I mean, you can kind of pick and choose what you want there. And that's the way we did it. So we basically had a certain amount left at the end. And everybody kind of threw in their pet project of what they wanted to see in there, and we worked up to get to the full $1.3 million. And so if there were a cost overrun, you know, we could, if necessary, drop some of those Steam items.
And do we have a list of... Do we have a list of ads if you come in 50,000 under budget? Are there?
We did. We looked at a couple of things that at the time we just couldn't fit it into the budget, and we do have a list of running things that we can add.
Okay. How long do you have to add? Like, I think of the Chromebooks, like, if we find that we would need more, like the way that we're doing it with the carts, would we be able to, how long do we have to hold that possible?
We don't have to expend it to, I believe, 2 years after they allocated. After we got the first approval. So we had to 2019, January 17th, I believe, 2019.
Thank you. Quick question.
There's one other one.
Yeah. On the wireless and, you know, the backroom infrastructure, do we have planned excess capacity? I mean, we don't have one now, but maybe down the road, is it bring your own device policy or, you know, something along those lines? Just in terms of bandwidth.
For the wireless infrastructure, one of the specifications I had with the companies that gave me the quotes, I say, these are the two things we're looking to do. We're looking to do, right now, get 30 Chromebooks on per classroom, no matter what classroom they're in, and we want to have the ability for BYOD in the future. So the access points that they've spec'd out definitely will be able to handle all of that. As far as our connection for the internet, that's something I'm working on with Lightpath to get a beefed up internet connection from them. To give us a little more bandwidth for that.
And then in terms of the wireless, it's presented as a single network, correct? So you can move from place to place.
Yes.
Thank you.
One more slide. So in implementing all this new technology, we've done some professional development to date too. We've had some initial faculty presentations. We went around to all three buildings and we presented our idea of going Google. Part of going Google was because we're getting the Chromebooks. Chromebooks, you need to have Google logins, Google sign-ins. So we went out to all the elementary schools and the district office and presented what it would mean to go Google, switching our email, switching our documents, sheets, slides, all over to the Google infrastructure and what that would mean. We also put up a great bunch of website links where staff members can go in and learn how to use Google Docs and Google Drive and, you know, see the online tutorials. Not surprising, Google's a very online company. All of their documentation is online. They have great YouTube videos on it and PDFs on it, so you can learn how to use all the various products. Leonard and I went through, we spent several days at each of the buildings setting up accounts for all the teachers and staff members. Everyone had to get a brand new email account. I'm sure you all know too, you all received brand new email accounts. We set everyone up with new accounts, set up their passwords, showed them how to log in, went through on that. We also went through all the buildings and provided some days of training on how to use the email and how to get into Google Drive, how to use that system. So part of it is the ongoing professional development. We're also looking into, when school starts up next year, possibly contracting with OCs or another outside source, how to train everyone to use, the teachers how to use Google Classroom. Google Classroom is a very neat piece of the Google app or the Google Suite infrastructure. That lets teachers create a virtual classroom because not only are teachers and staff members getting Google accounts, all of the students are getting Google accounts too. And that will let them access their information at school, they'll be able to get it at home, and teachers will be able to make a virtual classroom and they can post all of their lessons and any documents they want to share with their class, and they'll put it in their Google Classroom. So that's a neat part, product that, although I know a little bit about Google to be dangerous, not enough about classrooms, so that's something we're going to look towards possibly BOCES for contracting with them for professional development. But that's going to happen probably more to the beginning of this summer year.
That's the plan. Any questions?
The computer per classroom, is it? So we right now we have four computers. We'll only have one.
There's one computer, there'll be one computer per classroom.
Because
those end computer units up there aren't real computers. They don't work with Windows 10. They don't work with the new systems that we're getting in now.
Okay, and the document cameras, the Ladybug document, the same as we already have?
Same as we already have.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, our last presentation of the evening, as many of you have been here for the middle years program International Baccalaureate Program, and you've kind of caught bits and pieces at the end of all of those presentations with regard to the International Baccalaureate Diploma Program and the things that were going on with visits and things of that nature. So I've asked part of the committee, I know there's a large group of Dr. Trace, as well as Mr. Caswell and Rita and Golia, just to give the board an end of the year update on where we are and where we're headed. So, Ms. Golia.
Thank you. Hello again, everyone. So, you, as Mr. Stewart said, you know, for the last few years, we've been focusing on the MYP program, and we've done a tremendous amount of work this year exploring the diploma program. And even though both programs are under the International Baccalaureate umbrella, they are two distinct programs and really warrant separate scrutiny, separate exploration. And we've had an amazing journey, I think, this year as a high school team. I'm really happy that Mr. Caswell and Dr. Flintrace are here. Mr. Gorshevsky is here, too, you know, as the MYP point person. And so really what we're looking for tonight is feedback from the Board of Education, their thoughts, their questions, their ideas about moving forward with the International Baccalaureate Program, the diploma part of International Baccalaureate specifically. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Caswell again. And enjoy. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. So about 2 years ago when we first heard about the MYP journey, at the middle school, at the high school level, we felt better to ride the wave than get bowled over by the wave. So 2 years ago, we formed an exploratory committee, and frankly, it was Ms. Ngoli, myself, Dr. Flintrace, Mr. Roberts, and maybe one other person. Very small, but qualified group of individuals that were very interested. And, you know, we would kind of do some collegial circles and, you know, just kind of learn and what IB was about, because none of us really had a working knowledge except for Ms. Ngolia. And 2 years ago, we decided at the end of the school year, all right, let's kind of go to the next step. Let's do some visitations. You know, like we heard earlier, that's a great way to learn. So we decided, all right, maybe I'll go to a school or two, and I'll see where that goes, kind of a thing. So tonight's presentation is a snapshot of the school year that involved our exploratory committee that really became more of an exploratory, really became the IB committee. So we're going to look at some invitations, we're going to share some philosophies and program, and then lastly we'll share what we would like to recommend concerning moving forward. So, visitations. Probably the best takeaway of any visitation is that the IB program is individualized to each specific school. There are nine IB schools across Long Island. We happen to visit four of them this year. Some are small, some are large. The takeaway, again, is there's no necessary cookie-cutter approach. Yes, the IB curriculum is set, but how it's implemented on the granular level is very much up to the school district. So I just want to keep it apples to apples and just kind of give everybody an idea of what we experienced in our visitations. Our first one was Dobbs Ferry, which is in Westchester, a small school, somewhat comparable to ours. And there's a phrase there that's really, really important for the presentation. It's IB for All. And I'll keep going back to that. IB for All is what their current machination is. Dobbs Ferry began IB in 1998. And for many, many years, it was very much of an exclusive program where very few people were involved, staff-wise, student-wise. And through the years, it became almost divisive because it was like more of an us against them because people really weren't included in the process. The handful of teachers and kids that were in it really caused some strife. So new administration ruled into town, and for the last 7 years, this new administration has changed the whole makeup of IB, and they've made it an IB for All, meaning it's a school, it is an IB school, not a school that offers IB. Every staff member is trained. Every student takes some course, some piece of the IB in the high school. And you'll hear me speak more a little more about that as we go through some slides. Dobbs Ferry plans on implementing all three layers of the IB program, PYP, elementary years, MYP, of course we know middle school years, that's pending. So Dobbs Ferry is going to be K through 12 IB in the near future. And an important statistic is 25% of their current senior class, which was some 130 students about, are diploma candidates. And again, I'll explain that in a couple of seconds. Long Beach, very different. Large school, much larger class sizes. They have the diploma program, like Dobbs Ferry. They also have MYP, like we're going through at the middle school level, and a very similar number of diploma candidates, large number, but same percentage, taking a diploma program. Northport, even larger than Long Beach, no MYP, and a very small number, comparatively, of the graduating class, which is about 500 students, 8% are in the diploma program, much different. And again, we're really learning, wow, every school is different. I mean, if we went to every single school, we'd have we'd have a story for every single school we visited. St. Barbara's probably the most productive of all the schools we visited. Very, very similar in terms of size for us. And they're relatively young, where I mentioned Dobbs Ferry was 1998. This is the fifth year of their program that they've implemented. They're thinking about MYP, maybe, but they do embrace the notion of training all the teachers at the middle school level. And this year, interestingly, 13% of their graduating class, which was just a tad under 100, are in the diploma program, but next year's projections is literally 50% are going to be in the diploma program, which is absolutely significant. So, and another piece I wanted to mention is, and again, trust me, you know what the diploma program is when I'm done. Not every student has to do the entire diploma program. You can own a piece of it by taking individual courses, which would lead you to an IB certificate. All right? And again, this will all make sense in a couple seconds. All right, philosophy. If I took a survey of could be a staff, could be the community, you know, we wanted to say, hey, what is it that we want our kids that graduate to take hold of and be able to, you know, shine on the rest of the world, like characteristics, those type of attributes? I guarantee you that some of these words that I have up here would really be shared by people in the survey. Take any of this 10. Reflective, open-minded, caring. I want my seniors to be caring. Right? We talk a lot about, you know, these empathetic traits, these deep thinking traits that we want our students to be able to bring forth to their college and their career and becoming active-minded citizens. Well, these 10 words happen to be the IB Learner Profile. This is the anchor of the program. We forget curriculum. This is the philosophical basis of what IB is all about. Is they embed every one of these 10 words, all right, intertwined and embedded into every aspect of their program. And this is the key, everybody. IB is a program. Why do I make a big deal about that? Well, board, you've heard me for the last 7 years, ask you, and with your support, we've increased advanced placement courses, we've increased number of concurrent college offerings, and we continue to do that. And they're excellent, excellent opportunities for our students. I think the mistake that people make is they put a versus in front of them, AP versus IB, or concurrent college courses versus IB. It's not a competition. It's about opportunity and choices. AP, concurrent college courses, the Excelsior class you've heard me talk about, excellent opportunities, right? Taking rigorous college-level courses. But when we started to really understand what IB was about, we all said to ourselves as a committee, is it possible that there could be more opportunities for our students? That's where we're going. So I got a couple bullet points there. IB is a program. AP, the concurrent courses, are not a program in terms of it's a holistic vision. You're taking individual classes that aren't connected. Every aspect of IB is connected. And it's a learner-centered approach. It's not subject-centered. Assessments go over a two-year time span. Internal, external assessments. It's not a one-shot deal like our AP test or maybe final exam in a concurrent course. It's going on for a lengthy time period. Like I said, one of these, the bullet point there, deeper learning, inquiry, thinking. There was, in one of our visitations, we had a really rich discussion with the coordinator and a couple of other teachers. And this the IB coordinator was recalling when this person took a course, which is an IB course called the History of the Americas. And it was an entire semester course, entire year course, right? And they only studied two subject areas the entire year. It's amazing to think about that, because you take your typical American history course, you remember that, the revolution to what? Maybe Vietnam when you're in school, right? Yeah. Now we have to add even more, right?
No, I'm not entering.
You know, it's a survey course, and you know, you might spend, you know, maybe a day on this topic, maybe a paragraph in the textbook on Vietnam, whatever the case may be, right? That's a typical American history class. This individual had two topics they studied the entire year. Should we drop the atomic bomb? And U.S. involvement in Vietnam. That was the entire course. Can't get any deeper than that. So when you hear that, you're like, oh my gosh, as a teacher, you get excited. As a student, how can you not get excited? You know, you are digging deep, which is powerful. Everything's interconnected. It's interdisciplinary. It's embedded in every single subject area. And it's all anchored by the learner profile that I shared with you earlier. And getting back to the IB for All Jobs Ferry model, IB vision, IB school vision, and IB school means that it's a whole different approach to a non-IB school. Every kid in New York State takes English 9. If we have an IB school, that English 9 course, although not an IB program course, the English 9 will look a lot different than a non-IB school teaching English 9. So it's completely comprehensive. So we threw a couple terms out. I just want to kind of take a step back for a second. PYP, primary years. There are no Long Island schools that have this at this point. MYP, middle school year program. I think there's a handful. Of course, Center Richards is one of them. Diploma program is your high school. It's 11th and 12th grade. But that's not to say that 9th and 10th aren't included. That's the overall philosophy. So what is a diploma program? I'm an 11th grader. What does that mean? Moving forward, I have to take one course in six of the subject areas. In the, you know, you can see them there, English and arts and sciences and languages and electives and things of that nature. And in addition to taking my six subject area courses, I have to take courses and programs that are considered the core of the diploma program. And they are the extended essay, theory of knowledge, and what we call CAS, creativity, action, service. And this is what really makes IB so unique, so rich, and so deep. So I'm not going to go through this really in detail. You can look at this at your own leisure. But the extended essay, one of the three core areas, we're talking a two-year commitment to creating a 4,000-word research paper. And it's intertwined with everything you're taking. You're assigned a teacher mentor. You're researching the topic. And everything that you're working on is embedded in your coursework. It's all interconnected over a two-year time frame. So when you finish this, you finish the extended essay. I don't care what your score is. You finish this, you're ready for anything in life. Whether it's a college paper, whether it's an assignment or a project you have at work, you're going to be able to do much better than someone that hasn't gone through this. Creativity Action Service, CAS. I like to describe it as our CSIP program on steroids. CSIP, last 7 years, we've really done a great job at really raising the bar in terms of expectation about being involved in your community and your school. Some kids check the box. Some kids really have a vested interest and have really benefited from the opportunity to be involved. This now takes that to an even greater level. that everything you're doing is tied into their essay, tied into their coursework, and it's a project that they're going to design, again, over a two-year period, with faculty mentorship, with guidance, and talk about the deep, rich experiences they can have by fulfilling their CAS requirement. It's just taking everything on a deeper level. So I'm not just checking a box anymore. And talk about the preparation for their college application process and even in college. This is exactly what goes on. And then lastly, theory of knowledge is actually a two-year course that only students that are in the diploma program will take. And this is something that we were really able to learn a lot about, not only in our visitations, but in some of the professional development that went on. Evolving out of all these meetings and visitations throughout the year, you know, we quickly realized that the enthusiasm at the staff level was infectious. Where we started off with, like I said earlier, Mr. Roberts and Dr. Flintrace and myself and Mr. Goulet, we had people knocking on our doors. Hey, when can I go? When can I visit? When can I take courses? So Dr. Flintrace and I actually took advantage of that momentum, and we actually went to Rice University, which we reported out at the last board, well, a couple board meetings ago. And I had to take an administrative course. Dr. Flintrace took a course in the theory of knowledge, the first part of two. So, Dr. Flintrace, I think you probably can do a lot better job than I can. Just kind of capture the enthusiasm you had walking out of that rigorous coursework we had at Rice University.
Okay, so I was one of the door knockers, and I said, I have now been to a bunch of these schools, and I can't believe what I'm seeing happening in the classrooms where the students are learning this TOK, this theory of knowledge. So I said, please send me for training. I need more information. I need to find out how I can employ this in my own classroom. So off to Rice we go, and I spent 3 days learning about what this class is and how to teach it to our students. Basically what this does, if you can kind of get a sense from the circle here, is that the theory of knowledge is the center, the focus of every single thing that the students will do in all their courses. So again, to kind of go back and talk about this, the fact that it's a program, because of what's happening in each of the classes, that they're all feeding off of each other. So the language that's being used, interdisciplinary, becomes something that the students really become familiar with. So what they're hearing in social studies or a history class, they're hearing in an environmental science class, they're hearing in a anthropology class. And what the theory of knowledge allows them to do, it's an experience, and what it allows them to do is to start thinking about how to ask questions, and then how to gather data, and then most importantly, to reflect on that experience. So it's done in all kinds of different ways, and we saw it in the schools, and I saw it in the course. But it allows students to say, okay, I have to write a paper, or I've got to study something, or there's a problem environmentally, or I'm learning about something in a psych class. There's a problem, there's an issue. How do I get information about what that problem actually is? And then they do that. And then they put it all together and ultimately turn around and say, I either was able to work towards understanding the problem or solving the problem, or I wasn't able to, and this is why, and this is what I would do differently next time. And it just allows students to really work by themselves to do it. So, I mean, I wish I could even explain to you some of the different activities that we went through to do it. What's kind of interesting is that even I've talked to some of the middle school teachers, they're doing it in their classrooms already with the MYP. So those students are already having that experience. It would be wonderful if we could continue that for them in the high school and go even further with them as we go into the different, very specific content areas.
Dr. Flintrace is a very humble individual, and one of the most powerful lines I think I've ever heard her say was, when we walked out of Rice that day, and she goes, Ed, this is the greatest staff development I've ever had. And we're talking about a very experienced teacher who, as we all know, undertook a brand new advanced placement course this year in human geography.
And for Dr. Coltrane to say that, I thought it was very telling for me, you know, when we're bringing this forward, saying, wow, talk about embedding enthusiasm in every single staff member. And I think Dr. Coltrane is really an appropriate spokesperson for that. So, you know, I thank the board for supporting our ventures and whatnot, and, you know, more to follow. So why go to IB? Well, when you talk about, you know, the student experiences, and how do we know this? Well, you know, it's through our research. It's through our interviewing students and all the visitations. I mean, we're not just seeing teachers. We're with the students all day. And take a look at any one of these bullet points. You know, time management. You know, my son went to college this year. He was a disaster with time management. All right? And he's probably no different than half the other kids in his cohort going away. Boy, if he could have learned time management a little bit better at Rocky Point, things might have been a little smoother for him. Enhances the ability to think outside the box. Promotes independent inquiry. Any one of these you take a look at. Wow, if our kids could even take a piece of that, whatever they do, it could be college or but it could be career as well. It could be the military. These are life skills that we're preparing students for. And IB absolutely offers a pathway to these things. Same with the teachers. Right? I get a chance to promote open-mindedness among my colleagues, among my class members. It's just a powerful notion that I'm not just teaching content, I'm teaching content as a vehicle to thinking. And the last line in this slide is huge, because the shift to IB is not just a quick walk in the park. It is a ton of work. A ton of work. And Ms. Horachevsky, you know that firsthand, what's going on at NYP level. But when I talked to Sag Harbor, some of the individuals there, I took their line. It's work with good work, meaning it's noble work. That's the bottom line. It is a lot of work. And when I brought this up to the faculty, I gave the example of, hey, you know, you could be the greatest teacher on earth. Like, you know, I taught psychology as an elective, and I had my binder, which was like a magic box, and it was awesome, and kids loved it, right? And if I want to do IB Psych, I can take my beautiful magical binder box and throw it out. And I got to start from scratch. I'm not starting from scratch in terms of, you know, my life experiences, but it's completely different because of all the different layers that we've, you know, kind of, you know, thrown out tonight. But it's good work. And what was so encouraging throughout the whole year was, you know, our teachers aren't shying away from this. They're not shying away. They're not running away. They're banging down the door. But it's not going to be without its, you know, trials and tribulations. But this is something we're absolutely committed to. Now, there's a video you can take a look at that I'm not going to show you tonight. It's actually from Long Beach High School. You know, the night we were there, they actually were previewing it for a board meeting. And basically, it was a bunch of students that were in college now sharing their experiences. Mrs. Rayburn was she accompanied us to Sag Harbor and to Northport, so she's really been an integral part of the committee. You want to kind of share like what a couple of highlights of the video like that really talked about the student experiences? Just what you remember, because you did the same thing at the.
I think for me, listening to the students on the video and in Sag Harbor, it was really how much they own their own education. You know, they were talking about this. It's, you know, the extended essay. They have to pick their own topics. They have to work with a mentor. They're driving what they're researching and why they're researching it. Their CAST project, again, it's student-driven. It's what do they care about? What do they want to focus on? And how are they going to solve the problem or write the paper? I thought that, for me, I'm finding that really it's the talking to those students and listening, it's not just your elite students, it's all students. That one girl at Sag Harbor really just stands out for me because, you know, she took the challenge on, and when they go to college, that how prepared they are to write, to walk into a college-level class, or not even to go to college, to walk into the business world and be able to communicate, having worked with a mentor. You know, you can have dialogue with people, and you can take criticism, and you can grow from that, and, you know, it's okay if you fail, or it's okay if your experiment didn't work out the way you thought it was going to. What did you learn, and what would you do differently? And I think that, for me, those are very, very important things for our students.
So if you want to take a look at the video on YouTube, it really speaks to what Ms. Rayburn just said.
So let's talk about a timeline, because we're very excited at the high school level. Like I said, there's a lot of work to do, a lot of hard work to do, but it just makes good sense. Because, you know, the thing that I like a lot about this is it's the common expectation, it's the common vocabulary, it's the common professional development, and it just makes sense. It's just a program that's so embedded on so many different levels. So, that being said, we wish to continue our professional development, whether it's going to, you know, classes or seminars, whatever the case may be, this summer. We would really like to begin the application process, you know, organizing and preparing, because it's a labor-intensive process, in order for us to apply in the spring of 2018. And then we're talking a 2 to 3 year time frame, depending on how the process, you know, takes place. And we're looking at possibly having juniors beginning the diploma program somewhat around the year 2020, and they would be graduating with a diploma from International Baccalaureate in the year 2022. But one thing I want to stress is that one of the greatest takeaways for me was when I heard that Principal Dobbs Ferry, the second phase of Dobbs Ferry, the last 7 years, that said, you know, when it was a top-down, when whoever the powers in 1998 declared, when it was a top-down, it wasn't successful. When it was the opposite, when it was really a grassroots understanding of what was going on, and every teacher had a piece of it, and every kid has a piece of it, and the community has a piece of it, that's why this program has flourished, and that's why it's successful. So we don't want a school that offers IB. We want an IB school. And that's what has come out of our humble beginnings, and here we are tonight with what we've learned throughout our journey. Thank you. Any questions?
So, I guess I'm going to pull you in two different directions. First is, you've described this very eloquently, and you also described a lot of work on the teacher side, but also on the student side. You've got the 4,000-word essay, you've got the community service on steroids. What kind of a burden do you think this puts on our educational community, both the staff and the students, and ultimately the budget? And how much can we heap on? Is it realistic to think we can do this? What are we going to be, an 8% of our graduating class school? Are we going to be 12%?
One thing I would say, if you don't mind, just starting to go walk, is that, and those percentages, they throw you off a little bit, Marcus, because if I'm a student and I make the decision to take an IB dance class, and I want to take, you know, just a dance class. I happen to be a dancer. I'm very interested in going to college, maybe even in that area or in the arts. I can take just that course. When you talk about 8%, 10%, 20% being the full diploma candidate, that's when you get into the extended essay, you get into the CAS piece of it. So that's only a particular group. So that's what I love, Mr. Caswell, that when he keeps saying the IB for all, it depends how far I want to step into the arena, just as well as AP right now. Some students take one course and some take all five and go the distance that way, if that makes any sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, So the intention is, well, I think Sag Hall Brewster was a good model, because in the beginning, like any other beginning of any type of raising the bar and increasing rigor, is going to be a cultural shift. You know, the expectation is much different. But now, after 5 years, half of their class is going to be in a DP program, just a DP program. You know, like when you look at Dobbs Ferry, you could say 100% of their kids are taking an IB course. They're not taking a diploma program, but they're taking an IB course. English and math. Every English 11 kid in Dobbs Ferry is taking an IB course. So they walk out with a certificate. So like Mr. Stewart said, so it's a piece of it. And how much more do they take on? Another question. Ms. Rayburn, we heard that directly from the kids in every school, but really Sag Harbor. You know, because we were asking the same question, like, how do you guys do it? Well, when you went to senior awards night, you probably said to yourself, how do these kids do it? But they find a way. You know, because we keep saying, hey, here's the open door. Keep jumping through it, you know? So it's a cultural shift. It's a personal journey. It's a lot of things. It's hard to quantify, but intuitively, you know, like we look at our AP and concurrent, every year more kids are doing it. Kind of like the teachers. We had 4 people on the committee 2 years ago. Now I have 24. And I'm not forcing anybody. So it's kind of like a human nature.
When you look at some of the courses like physics now, you know, we've doubled in efforts on maybe more, maybe almost triple.
We have
in
physics AP now. Too.
And when we started doing that and students were taking that leap of faith, I think some of the community went, wait a second, can that many kids actually take the course? Now we got 91% that, you know, that passed the exam, and we had about 47% that mastered it, you know, this year. And we doubled or tripled the number of kids taking physics. So, you know, when they take that leap of faith, my personal opinion is, how much support are we going to give them? You know, as a family, myself with students here, as a community, as a school community in the school, they need to have a lot of support. You know, I think that starting at the middle years level was integral. You know, we didn't start at that. You know, some school districts have done it the opposite way, and I've been involved with that as well. Much more difficult, you know. But I think the direction we're going, although we don't have a PYP school, would be the first one on Long Island, and they're going to begin that investigation, I believe, the administration next year there. I believe that we are ahead of the game, kind of. You know, not behind the eight ball, because we didn't have that experience. And having Mrs. Orzechowski, who's been trained at all different levels, and many of the middle school teachers now, really helps us quite a bit. And of course, to have our master guru here of International Baccalaureate, Ms. Ngoli, also helps out quite a bit.
I think too, you know, to address the professional piece that Marcus asked, is that at first it is daunting, it's overwhelming. When you start to see the benefits on a daily basis in your classroom, and then you see those outcomes, and then the larger outcomes, the projects, the kids being engaged in things, it is very realistic at first. And there are some teachers, like I'm thinking about the physics teacher from Sag Harbor. He had an IB physics class. We went back into that class twice, and we really didn't see anything exciting. And the coordinator, I think, brought us there deliberately to show us you can still have professionals that may not be 110% on board for one reason or another. I've been teaching for 20 years, and what I know is tried and true. My kids are still going to have a great experience. And there's a part of the IB philosophy that embraces that, you know, they want the teachers to be who they are. They do provide a tremendous amount of support. So as Mr. Stewart said, it's the level of the work, but the teachers are extremely supported as well. And that's one of the things that, you know, since I've been here, in terms of the feedback from the staff, we have all these, like, one-and-done professional development opportunities that could be great. With IB, they really keep you honest in terms of professional development. You go for initial training with IB, but there are also expectations to go to other types of training, not necessarily through IB, but it could be specific training on, say, Socratic dialogue or just inquiry design model. And they kind of check in with you on a regular basis. They do 5-year review to make sure that you're appropriately supporting your teachers and your students, so that there isn't that breaking point, you know, within the program where the challenge and the burden of the program outweighs the positive outcomes that come along with the program. So I think that's one of the things that I think for me as a teacher and as an administrator that I've been most, that makes the program so successful. Like, once you're in, they don't let you fall, you know, and if there's a problem with a particular subject area that you're really struggling with, extended essay is a huge piece, I think, for us, especially as K-12, we spend a lot of time, like, looking at our writing program, because, you know, having certain levels of writing at every level from kindergarten through 12th is really an essential part of being successful in any rigorous program. So, for example, the work that we're doing with Teachers College, even though it has nothing to do with IB, that professional development work really supports the ideas behind the skills that the kids need to be successful in MYP or the diploma program. So it really, the IB organization really holds the school accountable and holds all that together and gives you a lot of guidance, advice, and how to put those supports in place.
You also
last part of the question was the financial piece, and we had the same concerns. Oh, sorry.
You got it. That's what I was going to hang on.
You know, so when MYP was first brought up, that was one of the first questions that the board wrestled with, and it really turned into a shifting of priority in our professional development budget. You know, and that's the same plan here. You know, I mean, I don't have those numbers on hand, but we're pretty confident it's doable.
Yeah.
You know, a little training has to take place.
Yeah, and the reality is you can't train everybody at once. I don't think it would be very overwhelming to train everyone at once. So they, you know, as you go through this application process, that's part of your plan. So there's, you know, Teresa and I similarly have worked with, like, what's the initial cost, and then
there are program fees once you're in the program.
Right, but you get, what do you get out of that? You get some PD, you get amazing resources that, you know, the reallocation and how we look at our overall, like for me, it's the curriculum, budget, and professional development. So, you know, within, you know, right now, we're looking at, like, what are the initial costs, and then what are the ongoing costs, like, by year?
The initial costs, like you were saying, you've been largely able to redeploy the money that we would otherwise be spending for general PD.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Right. That's
a piece of it. What?
Yeah, so that was the first part of my question. So reining you in and being cautious and saying, is this something that we really can handle in the way we're envisioning? But now I'll admit that I'm sold. And basically, from what you've said, everything I've read about ID, if you recall when Mr. Ed Busker was here, he said this was the premier program in secondary schools. So I think it's great. My question then would be, what's holding us back from going full steam ahead? So this is 2018 to 2022.
That's funny.
That's the exact same question that Mr. Forster asked at the middle school when we did this 3 years ago. There is a process.
But in fairness, and you taught me this, it's two processes. It's their process, but it's also the internal acceptance process. This fails completely and totally if people don't get as excited as you've gotten as part of this program. If it's a program we said, this is what we're doing tomorrow, whether you like it or not, the nature of people may say, I don't want to do that. So you explained that, and it took like three times for me to get it and understand it and not understand why we're not doing this tomorrow, and I get it.
And the rollout, like Josh says, is very important.
We watched
New York State. Watch what they did when they rolled out these exams without a lot of input. You know, what I love mostly about this, a lot of things I love about it, but listening to Mr. Caswell and Dr. Flynn Trace on how the committee started with a few and ended up to be so many. And that's just incredible to watch the collegial dialogue that's going on in the middle school and all these meetings with Ms. Argesti leading the charge and watching her come back Reggio from these conferences, you know, in different states, and it's just wow, you all get excited. And I've been in principal with the opportunity to not have it in the middle school, to go the other direction, although very successful. You know, I wish tonight, one of the things I wanted to happen tonight, we couldn't put it together in the end, but I would love to have five or six IB diploma students standing right there just speaking to you, because watching that over my career, over the last probably 15 years, the first time I witnessed just 10 or 15 of them speaking, I said, wow, you can just see the education these young people had. And watching them say, listen, I went to Harvard, and my roommate was from Singapore, and we were having the same conversation. We got this. It was incredible to listen to the level that, of their education. So I was wishing that tonight. I know we have some with the YouTube. I will put this on the website tomorrow morning. But it's not the same as maybe someday we will have them here. Just to have a group from any of the schools, any of them, pick any of them. It doesn't have to be like a top one saying no. Anybody that's experienced.
There's the range of students that you encounter, like as a teacher. You know, for me, I think what the program did, it kind of dismantled the typical high school structure. Within classes, and it invited more kids to challenge themselves because they knew they had more choice, more opportunity, you know, especially in the world of English language arts, to express themselves. And that opened the door for the challenge. So the challenge is always there, but the way the program is run, the way your classroom is run, entices kids who may be on the cusp of oh, I don't know, but that sounds really interesting. You know, like the TOK hook. You know, so you hook more kids who may be questioning whether they can handle something that has the rigor. You know, so for me as an educator, I think it pulled more kids into showing them how what their potential could be.
Okay, I have a quick question, I think. So basically, this is a way of teaching and a way of learning that's preparing you for college and for work and for life, and but it teaches the same thing, but it zeroes in on, like...
Yeah, if you go back to
like history, it'll just do the two parts.
If you go back to the learner profile, mm-hmm. you know, those are the philosophical attributes. Those are the building blocks of the program. The curriculum, whether it's math or science or language, is built around that, and it's all intertwined. You know, so if I take an AP course in AP Physics, it's a standalone. Mm-hmm. In U.S. History, it's a standalone. Mm-hmm. So, great classes.
Right.
But there's none of that.
But if you take the whole program, you're learning how to draw from everything and problem solve. And
correct. Or even if you have a piece of it, you're still getting a piece of it.
And you'll still take the state exams, you know, the regions exams, and that is going to leave. Right. To tell you the truth, those are not as important as the education.
But the benefit is you're being better prepared for life.
The fruits of the pudding.
So, next section of the agenda tonight is questions and comments on tonight's agenda. Anybody have any questions or comments on tonight's agenda, Alden? Mm-hmm. Motion to adopt the minutes of the regular meeting May 31, 2017, and the regular meeting of October 19, 2016. Motion.
Motion.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Yes.
Yes. Motion carries unanimously. So I've gone through this entire agenda carefully. I've got a couple questions, but I think, you know, some of this is largely appointments and reappointments. I propose to adopt certain portions in block. Everybody's opposed to that, let me know. If anybody's any specific questions on agenda items, let me know and I'll back them out of block.
Mr. Schaller, what's going on?
Wife's going to have a baby.
Oh, great. Good news.
Good news.
Thank you.
So it's 4 or 5 minutes. Oh, yeah, 6 minutes is fine. So, motion to adopt items 6 through 16 on the agenda. And I'm stopping there because I have some other questions on 17. Motion. Second. Discussions. Any discussion points on any of those items?
Good question. As far as our UPK contract, is that 2 years or 1 year?
1 year. All in favor?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Motion carries unanimously. Kara, before we go into 17, can you just talk us through, I think I understand exactly what the funding of the reserves is, where this money comes from, and can you spend a second to talk us through exactly what we're doing on item 17?
Want me to just start? Okay. Just so you know, the amount of money that you see, I don't want anybody to think that we are going to reserve these funds with this amount of money. You see right in front of you $1.2 million, right? Two for $500,000 each, and then one for $200,000. This gives the district the opportunity or the ability to actually put that money in if we have a surplus, right? We do know at this point in time, Carol's projecting, I think, approximately a $1.7 million surplus. We do know that we applied some of that surplus to the following year. So any additional money that comes, whether it's hopefully $500,000 like you project.
projecting maybe a little bit more, who knows, as we continue to tighten the belt right to the end, that money has to be placed someplace. So this gives us the opportunity to place it in these accounts. And you will see in a future Board of Education agenda, you will see actually our recommendation of exactly where to place it. But for purposes of being able to do it, you need to do this. We do it every year. That we need to be able to be approved by the board that we can place the money in if we get it. That makes sense?
So if there were another reserve, like a capital reserve, which I know has to be voted on separately, mm-hmm. we would talk about that and make a determination there if there was a capital project to be done.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
On the repair reserve, do you know off the top of your head, I don't mean to put you on the spot, what we have in that reserve and what's come out of it? So was there a replenishment?
Right now we have $500,000 in it and it hasn't been taken out.
Has not. Okay. From the retirement contribution reserve, that's more of a what we take out would go back, meaning?
Yes.
Okay.
We could use it that way, yes.
Yeah, meaning?
And then the same with the employee liability reserve, same thing.
So the employee accrued benefit liability reserve, is that vacation and sick?
That is the payout of sick.
Payout, sick, and vacation. Okay. So the concept is when we make the ultimate determination as to what surplus we've got after we apply that portion to the applied fund balance for next year, there will be a net dollar amount, so let's assume it's 1.2, 1.7 minus 1.2 is $500,000. We'll have a recommendation as to where that 500 should be applied, whether it's general. If we're capped there, it wouldn't go to general because we're at the 4. Then we'd have these additional specific reserves.
Exactly.
Motion. Motion to approve item 17. Motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Yes.
Yes. Motion carries unanimously.
Recommended action that upon recommendation of the Superintendent of Schools, the Board of Education approves the transfer of funds from the employee benefit accrued liability reserve for the payment of final settlements for retirees and increase the budget accordingly.
So these are contractual payments that we're obligated to make in return for accrued vacation and sick. Motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Yes.
Motion carries unanimously.
Recommended action that upon the recommendation of the Superintendent of Schools, the Board of Education approves the payment of final settlements for retirees as an employer non-elective contribution under 403B regulations in lieu of a direct payment in payroll.
Same thing mandated.
That's
for
correct.
403B.
That's
motion.
Motion.
Second. All in favor?
Yes.
Motion carries unanimously.
Recommended action that upon the recommendation of the Superintendent of Schools, the Board of Education approves the disposition of books.
Motion.
Motion.
Second. All in favor?
Yes.
Motion carries unanimously.
Recommended action that upon the recommendation of the Superintendent of Schools, the Board of Education accepts the following donation.
Motion.
Motion.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Yes,
motion carries unanimously. I want to thank the PTA. It's unbelievable. I don't know if you've all had an opportunity to see the wall wrapped in the Clayton Dewey, but it's amazing. I think it's really, really cool. And my kids walked by it and came home and talked about it a lot when it was put up. So thank you very much.
And there's more to come at the middle school with the mission statement that's going to be put in place by the main lobby. And that's due to the PTA as well. It's going to be really nice. Thank you.
It was
fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't answer the text.
Recommended action that upon the recommendation of the Superintendent of Schools, the Board of Education approves the recommendations of the Committee on Special Education and Preschool Special Education for the months of February, March, April, May, and June for the 2016-2017 school year and the 2017-2018 school year.
Motion.
Motion.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Yes.
Yeah. Motion carries unanimously. You can do 23 and 24 together.
Recommended action that upon the recommendation of the Superintendent of Schools, Board of Education includes item number 23 and item number 24 on the agenda.
So 23 is rescinding the policy GCG, which is professional staff probation and tenure, and 24 is third and final reading of the 5661 district wellness policy motion.
Motion.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Yes.
Yes. Motion carries unanimously.
Recommended action that upon recommendation of the superintendent of schools, the Board of Education accepts the following resolution. Resolved that the Central Purchase Union Free School District's calendar for the 2017-2018 school year is hereby amended as per the attached.
Motion.
Motion.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Yes.
Yes. Motion carries unanimously. Do we have what the amendment was
The amendment the community is on the November, at this current time, the November 22nd was an instructional day, and at this point in time, the board just approved November 22nd to be a parent-teacher conference day for the entire day for the students.
Recommended action that upon recommendation of the superintendent of schools, the Board of Education approves the following Board of Education meeting dates for 2017-2018 academic year. There is one change. The June 20th, 2018 meeting will be June 19th, 2018.
Motion.
Motion.
Second.
Second.
All in favor?
Yes. Yes.
The only reason we changed that was because we wanted to make sure the middle school moving up ceremony next year stays on Wednesday. So we have Clayton UM Monday, that on Wednesday, and then high school on Saturday. We wanted to stay consistent. So that's why we changed that, if anybody's interested.
Questions or comments from the community on items not on tonight's agenda? Anything else?
Hi, my name is Marcus Babzine, and let me preface by saying that I don't have any issue with the person that was chosen. I've known Tom a long time. I like him a lot, and actually I'm all in favor of tall people on the Board of Ed. But in all seriousness, I really have some concern with the way filling this vacancy was handled. So the day after the election, a number of people turned out to the board meeting, and the tenor of that meeting was actually, I think, quite good. The board listened to the community. There was discussion back and forth, and I don't know what happened at that point. To me, there was some kind of breakdown. So I'm going to read you something. Each person wishing to make a comment should be limited to 3 minutes, as has been past practice. Following comments, the Board of Education will discuss and vote upon whether to hold a special election or to appoint an individual to fill the vacancy caused by a recent resignation. That, of course, is the agenda from the previous meeting. And according to what I saw, that is exactly not what happened. That the board made a decision without any community input at that meeting, because the decision was made well in advance. So the concern that I have is, how can the board be taken seriously that they're accepting community input when they ignore the input at a public meeting? And I think that's a really serious issue, and I'm putting it before the board. Any member that wishes to comment, I would love to hear it. If you want anything to be on the record, I think that's great. And
so I can comment on that. I mean, and I'll tell you that we sat and we listened to many, many, many comments and viewpoints here at the first meeting. I remember what the date was. We gave our initial thoughts at that time as to kind of the process and what's going on. We had a period of time, which I thought was a great suggestion, to kind of reflect individually as to all of those comments. Every one of them, and I don't know how many there were, we can go back and count, but there were probably 30 people here and 20 people made comments. I took notes the next night, or the next meeting. The comments were almost identical. The comments were not based on different theories. The comments were not based upon, you know, different reasoning. The comments were largely based upon a vote, which... Let me think about my words here. The comments were based upon
what a small group of the community felt was the right thing to do based upon voting returns for a different election. That was the predominant comment that we got the first night. And as I said, I personally, and I know that other members did their own thinking as well and their own inquiry, spent an inordinate amount of time thinking through those comments, thinking about whether there was validity to the position that the person who received the third most votes was the community's choice for a seat that was not up. And in my view, the answer to that was a resounding no, for all the reasons that I stated, and I can give it to you again. So there was nothing in that second meeting, from me personally, maybe others felt differently, and I certainly pipe up, that was any different whatsoever from the first. People repeated the same thoughts. People supported an election, supported the board using its judgment. But other than that, it was the community has spoken. And in my view, in my analysis, in my thinking, I told you, I talked to statisticians, I talked to election consultants. That wasn't the election we had. So in answer to your question, I firmly believe that we did exactly what we are tasked to do, which is make a decision in the best interest of the community, not necessarily take what a small group of the community wants because they felt that that was the right answer and go that way because they were there the most vocal. We thought about it. I agonized over it. I lost sleep over it to try to make the decision as to what's best to move the community forward. So that's my view. I mean, if you feel differently, you're...
No, I concur with that. And I'll dovetail on that by saying the way I reflected on it was to look at what you would consider the third and fourth, you know, runner-up, if that has any validity, to say it was split down the middle, one vote difference. That reflects upon a community that was a divide, 50-50. So in any appointment, it would have simply alienated one half of the community. That's how I saw it.
I want you to understand that. I hope that you understand that the amount of time and thought that we all did.
Yeah.
To me, there was no. This was divisive, no matter what. There were no good options, honestly. Here, you know, and I think that we just did the best that we could, given the information that we had, the research that we did, and the thinking that we did.
I think we did exactly what we're supposed to do, which is use our judgment, make a decision as to what is best for the district moving forward. And that's what we did. For all the reasons that, you know, we stated in that meeting.
All right. Well, I appreciate that feedback. I would just follow up by saying when you put something like that on the agenda, it sends a very contradictory message when you all of a sudden make a decision and then call up somebody who in advance you've contacted to fill that position. Exactly.
Marcus, if someone came in and said...
And let me just say, look, the decision didn't have to be made until, July 31st, August 1st?
No, it absolutely did, because if we were trying to make a decision as to whether to hold an election, we worked backwards from dates, we spent hours and hours with our law firm, we had to make a decision. We ultimately decided to hold a special election, and I forget what the notice dates were, but we had to back out 45 days before to give notice and have the election before 90 days. We needed to make a decision if an election was on the table. And to your point, if someone had come up, and I walked in there, yes, hearing all of the comments that were made and having thought about it and having consulted our lawyers with a thought as to what the right thing was. I didn't just not think about it for 2 weeks and come in with a blank slate. If someone had come in and said, here's a great idea, why don't you try this? I absolutely would have said, wow, there's a great idea, why don't you try this? One of the things that we proposed at that meeting that day, which was, not supported and made to seem like a silly idea, was to take resumes, to take
the exact same thing
William Floyd did that everybody clapped their hands for. We said, give us a few bullets. Let us know how you're going to move the district forward. Everybody said that's a ridiculous idea. We've ran this already. Another district does the exact same thing a week later, and it's lauded as a phenomenal idea. So if someone had come in with a better idea, a better way to make a fair decision, not, well, they got the third most votes, so that should be the choice, that wasn't, in my view,
I'm not the end-all be-all, in my view, that wasn't a logical answer. You know, so I certainly would have listened. I have no dog in this fight whatsoever other than moving the district forward.
No, I accept that, but from what I saw at that meeting, this is not just my feelings. This is, I mean, you got a number of angry comments from people.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? And I'm sure you probably expected that, right? But to line things up the way that you did, it just made it look very bad. It made it look like you had it all decided. It didn't matter what anybody said. And now you're saying that, well, if somebody would have come up with an argument that you didn't think of and was convincing enough, that maybe Tom wouldn't be sitting here now. Maybe you would have delayed this decision. Maybe you would have decided later on anyway, which is fine.
That's the point of having a public comment. If someone came up and said, hey, guys, have you thought about this? Have you thought about if you do something this way, how it can help the district? I certainly would have said, wow, that is a phenomenal idea. Perhaps let's talk about that now. I didn't hear that. I'm not denouncing any of the comments made. I didn't hear anything different said that night than what was said the very first night.
Right.
You know, and I thought about every single comment. I went back and listened to the audio about every comment that was made the first night. I frankly talked to the lawyers about each one of them and said, what do you think? Does this hold weight? Does that hold weight? How do you think we should move forward? What do you typically see? You know, and I certainly did go in there with an open mind. I went in there with a thought as to what, for me, in my one vote, was a good decision. But there was nothing stated that would have, that at least to me, would have said, hey, go in a different direction. It's better for the district. It's better for the programs that we're pushing forward, the programs that we're supporting in the next year. It's better for the long-range view of the district. You know, I don't think any of the decisions would have been an easy decision.
No, but I think the community understood that completely. And most people would agree, no matter what you did, you were going to get flack. But I will maintain that the way you set things up at that last meeting, you made it a lot worse than it needed to be, and you generated a lot more ill will against the board than you needed to.
Okay.
I think nothing would have changed. You know, I don't know how much a fourth member or fifth member has contributed in the past 3 weeks, but you could have done without that member for another meeting. You could have pushed things back to at least make it look like you've taken the community's input.
So let me give you my view on that. There's also something to be said sometimes in making a decision and moving forward. You're right. We could have pushed things back. I don't know. I don't remember what the dates were, but enough to this meeting, perhaps, to decide. I don't remember where the 45 days are. But sometimes you have to. You've got the input. The input didn't change from meeting A to meeting B. Sometimes you make a decision. What you think is best, you move forward. You know, there's an election next year. I would absolutely love if you ran. I mean, anybody that's interested that would run, I think, it is a great thing to do for the community. A decision had to be made.
I understand that. And this is not about me being in a seat or Tom or any of the other candidates or whether or not you picked the right person. It's just there is a segment of the community which is now irritated again or newly irritated with the Board of Ed. And you know, we need the community support. And it doesn't... It's just hurting us
We absolutely do need the community support.
That's really the way the process was handled. That's all I'm saying.
Quite honestly, that segment of the community would still be irritated unless that single decision was made that they were looking for. That's the bottom line.
That's fair enough.
How can you say that?
There were no other suggestions put out there.
But the only difference is that Lori decided she wasn't going to run, so you made the 50%, 50-50. If you bring up the 50-50, she would have
an equation. I don't
understand
what you're saying.
You were talking about we made a decision that it was a bit downside, that because it's split.
No, this is how I interpreted it in my thought process, you know, thinking about this and agonizing over it for weeks. That's how, you know, I rationalized it based on the community commentary that somehow the third, fourth, and fifth number of votes counted for this appointment. So based on that, I looked at it and simply said, if you want to look at it that way, it's 50-50. The community is divided down the middle. Half turned out for Mr. Maxwell, half turned out for Lori. So either appointment in either direction would have alienated half the community. And based on, you know, Mr. Babzian is saying, the only outcome, and Mark isn't saying this, but the only outcome that would have been considered fair by the group of people who are now criticizing our decision is if Mr. Maxwell had been appointed. That's it. I mean, if somebody else had brought a viable option to the table at the last meeting instead of screaming at us and heckling us, perhaps we would have been able to take that and work with it at that moment. That's my take on it.
There are people in the community that would have been 100% fine not appointing George Maxwell. I am one of those people. Okay. I trusted the board. I trusted that you would make a good decision. But the way it was handled at the last minute, the impression that you gave a lot of people, including myself, was that you had made your decision and you were disregarding what the community said. We knew before there was the first comment. Everyone knew the decision that was going to be made that night before anyone commented. That's what was frustrating, and that's a shame.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other comments on items not on tonight's agenda? The next meeting of the Board of Education will be July 11th, 2017, here in the district office. Motion to adjourn to executive session for purposes of discussing matters that will peril public safety if disclosed, discussions regarding proposed pending and current litigation. Collective negotiations under the Taylor law with various individuals, and superintendent review of superintendent's rubric. Motion. Second.
All in favor?
Yes.
Motion carries unanimously. So I want to take a minute to thank Lorianne Patangio for her service for the last year. It's a tough thing to do, and I think that you brought a lot to the table. I think that the conversations that you had, the viewpoints that you had, the writings that you've done to the district news were great. I personally enjoyed getting to know you and working with you, so thank you very much on behalf of myself and the board.
Thank you.